Welcome to Washington in Focus, your source for the week's top stories in the state of Washington. I'm Cole Lauterbach, managing editor for the Center Square Newswire Service. This week, we will be discussing new documents showing Governor Jay Inslee was forewarned about the state's carbon auctions increasing the price at the pump as a whistleblower complaint about the issue remains unanswered. How the state's independent grocers say regulatory relief in 2024 could make your run to the store more affordable. How Spokane County voters are facing a ballot next month that could resemble a middle school Scantron test, and how a city manager in Western Washington will get a $116,000 golden parachute after being ousted after little more than 3 years on the job. That's ahead in Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach.
Knowledge is power, and you deserve to know what happens in your state government. That's why the nonprofit Franklin News Foundation is bringing you straight news journalism through the Center Square, reporting on state authorities and publishing stories that show where your money goes and who spends it. By supporting the Center Square, you can track politicians' use of taxpayer money and demand transparency from elected officials. This is how we can equip everyday Americans to hold their government accountable. Become a supporter of Franklin today at franklinnews.org/donate.
Welcome back to Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach. Now let's jump into the headlines. Our first story comes from documents showing that despite his continued claim that Washington's Climate Commitment Act wouldn't affect fuel prices, Governor Jay Inslee was told by his chief policy advisor that the state's carbon auction would increase the cost of gas. So not only did Inslee know about the increase in fuel prices that was to be expected, he heard about it from some of his most trusted experts, and this happened all the way back in 2014. Washington editor with TCS joins us, Brett Davis. Brett, did those predictions, what did they exactly say a decade ago?
The Washington Policy Center, they unearthed or found documents for reports for the governor's 2014 Carbon Emissions Reduction Task Force, or CERT. Chief policy advisor at the time, Matt Steyerwalt, hopefully I'm pronouncing his name correctly, told legislators a carbon tax would significantly increase gas prices. Specifically, he told the Senate Environment, Energy and Technology Committee that a high carbon price scenario with a carbon dioxide cost of $52 per metric ton, which is actually almost identical to the state's current price at its carbon auctions, would increase gas prices by about 44 cents per gallon. The calculations the Inslee administration used to come up with those are the same ones used by the Washington Policy Center. And back in 2022, they came to a conclusion that gas prices would increase by about 46 cents per gallon. So there seems to be some match there.
Yeah. So you're looking at back in 2014, one of Governor Inslee's, chief in his cabinet of environmental experts said in 2014 that this would, as it stood, this plan, the Climate Commitment Act, as they had it designed back then, would have increased the price of the pump by 44 cents was the estimate. And now we're saying, I mean, he wasn't too far off, right? Look at what is the average running estimate now, is it right around 50 cents? So he actually undersold it a little bit.
It's somewhere around there. I've seen estimates anywhere from 40 to 50 cents. So he was pretty close.
Yeah.
Problem with this is that back in the summer of 2022, this is before the carbon tax went into effect at the beginning of 2023, Governor Inslee said, you know, he thought this was only going to cost pennies per gallon. So that got a lot of play at the time. So there seems to be a disconnect between what Governor Inslee said back then and the actual cost of a gallon of gasoline. It seems like he knew, but he's been maintaining that this seems to have caught him by surprise, the actual price increase.
Now, you're right. And to credit to the local media over that period, he had been pressed on that where, oftentimes the governor will say something, there'll be a release and somebody, a reporter will just say, OK, he said it. That's what it is. He faced a pretty significant amount of continuous pushback on the assertion that, yes, this carbon auction will increase prices for oil and gas companies, but the price at the pump is not going to change, and like you said, pennies, if anything. The governor really did maintain that for what was years, correct?
And yes, and in the Washington Policy Center blog, you know, even mentions that at the time, Crosscut even ran a story about this. So it wasn't like it was not out there at the time. You know, people seemed back then anyway, seemed pretty honest about what this was going to do to gas prices. But a lot seems to have changed in the meantime.
Right. Well, and also beyond the governor's advisors saying, listen, back in 2014, saying, listen, governor, here's what we're looking at. As it stands, the economic models say we consider this becoming a 44 cent per gallon increase at the pump if this becomes a reality, as is. You also had environmental groups,
right,
who favored the policies, who wanted these things passed and fought for them, so that the CCA in Washington actually has much more stringent standards than other places that have these carbon auctions, namely California, the home of progressive environmental policies, and Quebec in Canada have the same thing. They supported this wholeheartedly, but said the same,
right,
that the governor's advisor did. Yeah, there's, we expect this to increase the price by about a half a buck, right?
Yeah, there's a left-wing environmental group called Climate Solutions, and they spent about the last 2 years denying that the climate tax would increase gas prices, but that's not what they said back in 2014. Casey Golden, he's the head of that organization, and he was subsequently appointed to the Northwest Power and Conservation Council by the governor, wrote in a letter to CERC that the very purpose of this was to increase gas prices and shift people away from fossil fuels. I mean, he just came right out and said it.
Right. So. Yeah, it was one of those kind of quiet part out loud moments where they said, yes, the point of this is to make this so expensive that people decide to drive less or buy an electric vehicle or essentially shift away from fossil fuels, which, if you've ever heard the governor speak for more than 5 minutes about any topic, he will mention the evil of fossil fuels and right, how it's affecting the climate and such. That just suddenly, I mean, even though they said this back in 2014, as it came down to the wire to get this thing enacted into law, all of a sudden that message kind of changed. I do wonder if they, you know, focus grouped this out and found that an estimation of an additional 50 cents per gallon at the pump made people that would support or not support this, that actually mattered, voters, et cetera, say, yes, I agree with this, but I don't want an extra 50 cents a gallon just because of it.
It's politically inconvenient, to say the least.
Absolutely. And so what we saw was that the message kind of changed and it became kind of this, well, no, this may have not been said. This, no, it will not affect the price at the pump, if anything, pennies, as it finally came down to it. As you mentioned, the Washington Policy Center has been the forefront of warning about this. And they had this prediction out there and have been, you know, like the guy on the corner with the sandwich board saying, you know, screaming from the mountaintops, this is going to increase the cost at the pump. And they were dead on right and vindicated in this.
And now they have support from the governor's office from several years ago. So.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, you know, in response to these documents coming out, what are they saying about this moving forward?
Their take is basically that the governor has been lying. He knew the whole time that this would increase gas prices, but for political convenience, you know, he has drifted away from that. And so, you know, hence the comment about pennies per gallon. Mm-hmm. Basically, they're saying he's being disingenuous. I have a, you know, request for comment into the governor's office, so we'll see what they have to say.
Right, right. So, Brett, do you think this will fuel the momentum for the ballot initiative to scrap this program coming up in 2024?
I don't see how it couldn't.
Yeah, because Let's Go Washington, the organization that was behind it, didn't necessarily say, well, you know, we don't want to protect the climate. They're saying we were lied to in the entire process of putting the Carbon Commitment Act into law, and we would like this, you know, like this done on dishonest grounds. We would like it scrapped. And so I wonder if this is going to be that call to action to say that, you know, the supporters of this, something in the governor's office, the ardent supporters, knew years ago, a decade ago, that this would become a 50 cent per gallon increase at the pump, and knew it wouldn't go over well, so decided to pivot on messaging just so they could get it past the finish line.
And it seems like they turned in more than enough signatures, so I imagine this will make it to the legislature and will be on the ballot next or this year.
Absolutely. Yes, this year. It is 2024 now.
So. I almost forgot.
I know. I'm still writing 2023 on everything. Thank you, Brett. Moving along now, I'd like to touch a little bit on your local grocery store, the Washington Food Industry Association. They're a statewide trade association representing independent small grocers and convenience stores. They say the state regulations are inflating your costs at the checkout counter. I'm pleased to have with us for this story our Capitol reporter, Carlene Johnson. Carlene, the nation as a whole is suffering from inflation, but Washington's mom and pop grocers say they're getting a little extra pressure from what they refer to, I guess you'd call it state red tape. What are they listing?
Even the big guys are feeling it, but the little guys always feel the pinch a little bit more than the rest of them. So as you mentioned, the Washington Industry Association that represents these smaller grocers. I spoke to their CEO yesterday, a gal by the name of Tammy Henricks, and she tells me the Climate Commitment Act, those regulations are killing the small grocers and the convenience store operators. You add in crime and everything else that they're facing right now in the world. And if you go into some of these smaller grocers in the rural areas of the state, you might find that items are two or three times what you might pay for them at, say, Costco or Walmart. Because, of course, they've got the massive buying power and they could absorb some of the additional costs. Now, when we talk about the Climate Commitment Act, you know, most folks are aware that it's inflating grocery prices. And then you add on the diesel prices our truckers are paying just to get those goods from the warehouse to the distribution center to the store shelf. And some of our smaller grocers and convenience store operators are not able to absorb it.
I mean, that's the one thing that people don't necessarily think about is that, you know, those vegetables, those cans and boxes, they have to make their way out to these grocery stores. And often mom and pop grocers, you know, if you live in, say, you know, Tacoma, you're going to have a lot of different options. But if you're, say, out in, you know, rural eastern Washington or central Washington, it takes some diesel fuel to get all of those deliveries out to these local small owned businesses that are grocery stores that people in these small towns rely on. And the Climate Commitment Act has boosted the cost of the very bottom line. So they're charged with what's known as a fuel surcharge. So every time one of these trucks shows up with the groceries that these small towns rely on, they are the grocer is paying that right off the top. And they have no other choice but to pass that down to their customers. Otherwise, they're not going to stay alive. They're going to go dark. And leave people like, you know, me as a kid growing up having to drive 45 minutes just to get a gallon of milk. You know, what are you seeing, Carlene, when you hit the grocery store in your hometown?
Well, I'm lucky enough to live in Federal Way, Washington. Let's just put it like that. And even at my local Safeway earlier this week, went in and the produce department looked like peak COVID. Cleared out. Literally, I could not buy a head of lettuce. It was insane. There were no russet potatoes. And the manager, I know him, so we were speaking at the checkout line because heaven forbid he could find anybody who wants to work at the store. So the manager's pulling 17 hours straight. He tells me their shippers, you know, a couple of their shipments were running behind. And I'm like, well, is that, what's that related to? Well, you know, he kind of hemmed and hawed, said this time of year, holidays, hard to say exactly what you would attribute that to. But when you think about the rural grocer who maybe he's supporting his local grower, local egg, right? And so that local grower is selling direct to the local small grocer. But again, as you mentioned, that costs all the more. I mean, at every single level, these guys are getting hit. And then, Cole, you add in crime. It is everywhere. And the related drug crisis and all of it goes, you know, circular. But these guys are hurting big time.
You mentioned crime. And I mean, we've seen, you know, reports in Seattle and reports in other big cities like, you know, where you're at, you know, Tacoma, Federal Way, about these security videos, seeing people just rushing local grocery stores and pharmacies and such, just going out like it's Black Friday, but they're not hitting the register. In terms of a local mom and pop business, you have the laws of, you know, bulk and scale, where if this were to happen to one of these small shops, limited inventory, limited overhead, it's not just an insurance payment and an absorption of loss into the, you know, into the margin. This could be the death knell for one of these small businesses, right?
And then you get hit 3, 4, 5 times in a single week, month, which is actually happened here in Western Washington to many of these small owners. And even that people realize they see a 7-Eleven and they think, okay, well, they've got all the buying power, whatever, they're a big deal. Yeah, most of those are single owners franchises. We've had a couple of them shut down here in the Federal Way area recently. One guy got hit so many times, and the last straw, which is another smash and grab that closed him down for good, boarded up the building right off of Pacific Highway South. These guys got in there, and I don't know if it was the Kia boys or some of those other crazy punks that are out there pulling this stuff off, but they stole a bunch of the vape products and all that. It was a $50,000 hit in one smash and grab. Can you imagine what that does to a single business owner? Not to mention the fact you can't get an employee who wants to work at the 7-Eleven at 2 a.m. and, you know, every other customer is a bad guy.
Yeah. Then all of a sudden you can't hire people. Hence going back to your, you know, reference about a 17-hour shift for the manager who could be the owner of the business in these type of situations. Now, Carlene, if those small IGAs and others close because they just simply cannot absorb the cost of the red tape and the result of the crime, you could see an issue where we're seeing across the country now, not only in rural areas, but in urban areas where there is high crime called food deserts. Well, the closest grocery store is miles away from people's homes. And if you're in an urban area and you don't have a car, this is, you know, a major, major problem. You know, the folks that you talk to in Federal Way, it might not be that much of a concern, but you know, your years in speaking with people across the state, how much of caution are they taking when they're seeing this increase in crime and local businesses start to close?
Well, you end up with people doing the crazy panic buying like we did during COVID, and that just exacerbates the problem, right? I'm not immune to it. Let's just make sure that we have all of our supplies if and when the world ends, which could be tomorrow at noon, right? And so people are already doing some of that panic buying. Yeah, then you get in those rural areas. If you can't find the basics like toilet paper, echo there to COVID, batteries, meat products, you get further out and further out, more like-minded people along that route, it is going to create more and more of those food deserts. I don't see a way out of it at this point.
All right, Carlene, if I continue on with this, you're going to turn me into a doomsday prepper. So I appreciate it.
Sorry to be so optimistic.
Thank you so much for that. Moving on to Eastern Washington, we have a whole bunch of levies coming up in Spokane County's February 13th special elections ballot. Joining us is Eastern Washington reporter Randy Brock. Randy, this week you reported that a majority of voters living in Spokane County likely to see at least one money measure or proposition that could affect their pocketbooks when ballots get mailed out later this month for special elections slated for February 13th. Here's most of them pertain to school districts. What's happening there?
That's the case in all Spokane County. Elections officials have put together a sample ballot that's got 26 separate propositions. And this affects 13 area school districts that are seeking voter approval of property tax levies for educational programs and operations, commonly called EPOs, that would replace existing levies that expire at the end of this year. So a number of these measures are not really new. What they're asking is to renew what's in place right now. And the affected school districts include Central Valley, Cheney, Deer Park, East Valley, Freeman, Great Northern, Liberty, Meade, Medical Lake, Nine Mile Falls, Riverside, Spokane, and West Valley. So there's a bunch of them. Additionally, voters in Central Valley, Cheney, Freeman, Liberty, and Medical Lake school districts are also being asked to okay a second levy proposal to fund security, infrastructure, and technology improvements.
The school districts can have different types of levies then. Can you explain the difference?
Well, in Washington, a few years ago, the legislature changed it. Back in the old days, you just had one M&O maintenance and operations levy, but now you can have a couple different types. There's the EPO levy that we just mentioned. It can run from 1 to 4 years in length. There's the capital improvements technology levy that can run up to 6 years. And a school district can also run a transportation funding levy, which is limited to 2 years. Under state law, public school districts only need a simple majority vote to pass a local levy property tax funding measure. If it's enacted, the district can collect up to $2.50 per $1,000 of assessed property valuation within the district. And if they get that revenue, the levy money goes to support school functions that aren't directly paid by the state. And this has been an issue of litigation that dates back to, there was a Supreme Court ruling on this back in 2012 called the McCleary decision, that the state legislature boosted funding for schools for basic education, which pays for teachers. But a lot of this other money for aides and other programs has to be funded locally. And this might include sports, extracurricular activities, security, like we mentioned, technology, food services, staff training, and certain programs like college and the high school. Another component is something called levy equalization assistance. And there are certain school districts that live in areas where the property valuations have less assessment, and so they generate less money. And in those cases, the state can provide additional assistance to them, but the only way the districts can get it is if they pass their levies. So you can't get levy equalization money if you don't approve a levy.
Well, I mean, that's going to be an easy sell for them, because it's going to be, hey, pass this and we get free money and your taxes don't go up. And that's been largely the complaint about funding schools and funding local projects and such by property taxes, because you have property poor districts then who don't really have much assessed value because of their home size and valuations. But then you also have more affluent neighborhoods who have a lot of money and will have nicer schools. And that is their effort to try and kind of even things out. But this is also, levies are only one aspect of how the taxpayer gets hit. What about bond measures?
Bond measures are also involved. They talk about levies being for education and bonds being for buildings. So in this regard, there's five school districts within Spokane County that have proposed long-term multi-million dollar bond sales to finance new construction and renovation projects. And those districts are Cheney, which is going to seek a bond measure, $72 million proposed bond measure. It would be repaid over 21 years. Deer Park's got a $62 million 21 measure. Riverside's looking for $73 million over 25 years. Spokane's got the big one. It's $200 million to be paid back over a 20-year, and then West Valley School District is looking for $92 million over 21 years. Each of these districts is considering construction of at least one new school building. Several of the proposals are in regard to elementary schools, and then they want to use the money also to either renovate or modernize some of the other existing buildings. Under the short-term levies, bond measure's got a different set of requirements. To get approved, it needs at least a minimum of 60% voter approval. It also has an addendum that's called turnout validation, which represents 40% of the people who cast ballots within that district during the last general election. So there's been instances where the necessary majority of voters might approve the bond, but they didn't get enough voters to turn out for the election to validate it. So the measure actually fails.
It actually fails, right? Yeah. Well, I guess, and that higher threshold is more of a taxpayer protection, because you're borrowing money, and that should be something right. That I would think, the framers of the system as it was filled out are saying that this is a serious measure and it shouldn't just be something that's decided by 50 plus one. So county election officials in Spokane County will be mailing out ballots by January 26th. To start an 18-day voting period ending at 8 p.m. on Election Day. Thank you, Randy, for that. Thank you to all of our journalists for sharing their stories. Stay up to date with all of these stories and more at thecentersquare.com. I'm Cole Lauterbach, and until next time, this has been Washington in Focus.